Welcome to the Half Percent Podcast. My name is Nick Plosser. I want to thank everybody for joining. Before we get going, I want to please encourage everybody to make us part of your feed. Hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to podcasts. We're available, Apple iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify. Tune in, iHeartRadio, and make us part of your feed. And we really appreciate it. Spread the word, all that stuff. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, social media, Twitter, all your social media outlets. We really appreciate the help spreading the word. Today's guest is Peter Doyle, and Peter is a major in the U.S. Army. He's a physical therapist and director of human performance for the 101st Airborne, stationed in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And I really, really enjoyed this interview. Peter's a really interesting, dynamic, positive guy, man. Dude has been all over the world and everywhere the Army takes him, and probably quite a few places in between. And he was just the Army should give this guy a bonus, man. He's a great advocate for choosing a career in the military. You know, starting from a small place in West Oregon, and you know, just to see where his career has taken him is really impressive. And to see kind of the passion he speaks about his career in the military. So his experiences everywhere from Iraq to Italy, South, you know, Asia, Far East, all points on the map. So really appreciate Peter giving us his time. And so without further ado, let's get into the show.
Okay, Mr. Push-Ups, let's hear your story.
It's not just the uniform, it's the stories that you tell. So much fun and imagination.
From now on, you will speak only when spoken to. And the first and last words out of your filthy sewers will be, sir. Do you maggots understand that?
Okay, we're rolling. I'm with Peter Doyle. Major in the U.S. Army. Introduced him before the show, but I will let him introduce himself. But Peter, thank you very much for joining, man.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate the offer and the opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the Half Percent Podcast is about getting to know people that choose a career in the military, and hopefully getting some funny, ridiculous stories along the way, man. Let's just start with a bit of basic bio. You're originally from Oregon, and you come from a big family, man.
I do. I'm number 8 of 12. We had a bunch of boys and 5 girls, so 7 and 5, and then, you know, just crazy.
Your poor parents, man.
Absolutely. You know, Irish Catholics, you know how
they are. Ah, right. Okay, there we go. Take the Lord's first commandment real literally, man.
Absolutely.
Cool, man. Well, you know, usually I kind of want to get what I'm kind of curious about with people that you know, that choose your line of work or to go into the military and the service is kind of was there something in your childhood or growing up, or did you have family connections to the military? Was this, or are you kind of the astronaut of the family? What kind of got you to get there?
Well, I'm definitely not the astronaut. I think it's interesting. I think all little boys kind of play guns and play soldier when they grow up. So that's pretty common. I didn't really have a dream to be in the military. I did have a couple brothers and cousins and everybody that's got a relationship with the military. So it was something that was easy to kind of look at, especially when it turns out I was a pretty horrible student in high school. I graduated, but I was not exactly like first in the class. I think it was the bottom third would be probably more accurately
described. You and me both, brother.
You and me both.
And a lot of that, I didn't go to school very regularly. I didn't take it very serious. And by the time I did graduate, I knew that there was no hope of me going to a great university or doing anything. But not a big deal. I had a brother who was in the military, and I said, you know what, that's a great backup plan. And, you know, I'm going to go ahead and do that. And that'll set me up, get me money for college. And then I'll eventually go do the things that I want to do after I kind of reset myself in the military. So that's kind of how it began for me.
Okay, and you mentioned you kind of got in, you were ready to roll kind of in high school. Well, you were still in high school, is that right? You kind of got out early a little bit?
Well, it's not out early, but I enlisted early. So the writing was on the wall for me that I wasn't exactly going to get offered a bunch of scholarships. And as one of 12 kids, they weren't going to give me money to just blow at a college, especially with my track record in, in academics. So I knew it was going to be the military that was going to be kind of my avenue. And so during my senior year, I did that delayed entry program, and actually myself and my roommates were all planning on joining the military together. They kind of drug their feet, and so I signed up and got ready to go, and then they didn't join the military really till about 9 months after I had.
Okay, cool. Okay, yeah, you meant that. Sorry, I meant, yeah, you got out of your parents' house early.
Apologies. Oh, absolutely. They kind of gave me some ultimatums on my behavior and times that I was arriving home, and I kind of crossed the line, and they softly booted me out, but then they also co-signed for my apartment that my friends and I got. So it wasn't a complete abandonment, but they definitely wanted me to grow up and learn some consequences, which I appreciate. We still have a great relationship. So
yep, absolutely.
Nothing horrible.
My mom did me that great favor. Didn't like it at the time, but was so grateful for it later on in life. So yeah, absolutely, man. I get that. Did you have initial plan when you went into service to do a 4-year stint, and then you had some career plans beyond that, or did you kind of think maybe this was something long term?
So I was looking at it as a glide path to pay for college. I'm a physical therapist now, I think, as you mentioned, but it's something I wanted to do. There was a friend of mine whose dad I really thought was a cool guy and did a great thing. He was a physical therapist. And so that was kind of like in the back of my mind, I wanted to do that. And the military was a way to pay for that for me. So it wasn't initially a plan to stay long term. I was going to get in, get the education money, and get out. But things morphed over time.
So that answers the question. You were pretty set on becoming a PT early. What were the things once you got in that kind of, real quick, I had a question. So the military paid for you to go to school at a regular university, civilian university for your PT school?
So it did, but it's a civilian university that's affiliated with the military. So what I did was I did the basic 4 years. I met my wife during that time, and I re-enlisted to go to a kind of a cooler unit while I was in the Army, and also kind of see where things were going with my girlfriend, now wife at the time. So right. I ended up, my initial time enlisted was about 6.5 years. And then I used the GI Bill that the Army gave me. Plus I joined the National Guard, actually the Air Guard in this case, because of where I was living in North Carolina, I didn't want to be in tanks. And so I looked for a kind of a cool Air Force unit. So I did the JTAC thing while I was in the Guard.
Oh, right.
So they gave me GI Bill from the Army and from the National Guard to pay for my undergrad, and then that also, you know, paid for a house for me. It made life pretty easy coming out of the military and going to school. It was comfortable, I can say. But then I applied for the Baylor DPT program, which is the Doctor of Physical Therapy program that Baylor has, but it's affiliated with the U.S. Army. So the Army has the instructors and the program, and it's actually just accredited to Baylor University of Texas, but actually the campus that I attended is in Fort Sam Houston. And then they paid me full time to go to school as an officer in the Army. So also a really nice gig. So
not that only, ain't, yeah, that's not bad, man. Okay.
Paid well, for I, it, and they paid me.
So okay, yeah, I see why you stayed. Okay, that makes sense, man. Well, cool. All right, so that answers some questions I had of your motivations and how you got there. How'd your parents feel about you choosing this career?
You know, they don't really have any reservations towards the military. My family, and I think most American families are very patriotic. They look at the military as what it is. It's you know, we all need national security and protection from whatever there is. We're a powerful superpower, and there's a lot of competitors and near peers and other nefarious forces also that are looking to have what we have. And so I think they value the military, and I think they're very proud that three of their sons have joined the military. So it was not discouraged at all. They were quick to sign, and they had to sign me in because I was a minor when I did my delayed entry program. So my parents had to sign the paperwork to allow me to get in the military.
Cool. Okay. Yeah. That's good. I was just, you know, because again, you talk to a bunch of different people and we all grow up in very different places and, you know, families with different, my parents were Berkeley 60s people, and not necessarily anti-military, but I come from a huge family of military people. And so up until that, my mom's generation. So it's just kind of interesting. I was going to go in the Marine Corps, and her attitude towards it was a little different at the time. So I'm always curious to see, when I talk to people, how their families responded. You know what I mean? And then you said you met your wife during that time. Was she also in the service?
No. So actually, I was a young private at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and we would go to college towns to meet women. Because Fort Bragg is very, very heavy populated with men. In college towns, it's about the opposite. We used to
Absolutely.
Say Chapel Hill was like shooting fish in a barrel, I guess is what we called it.
target-rich environment, man.
Absolutely. And, you know, you're a young kid and you want to go out and have fun. So I actually met her at a club outside of UNC Chapel Hill where she was going to school. She was an undergrad for communications and psychology. She ended up later becoming a nurse, but I met her while she was a college student, and then we kind of just, because I was stationed at Fort Bragg, we stayed together, and it was very early on
in
my career that I met her. So some interesting, challenging things that she's had to deal with the dumb young soldier, but but a lot of fun and a great relationship now.
Awesome.
We have, you know, four beautiful kids, so happy. But yeah, I did meet her because of the military, and then I actually stayed in the military longer because of her. If I hadn't been serious with her, I probably would have gotten out after my first term of enlistment and gone to school, probably in Oregon or in Washington State or California, some of the West Coast where I identify as being, you know, from. But because of her, I stayed in a little bit longer, did some other things in the military just that would keep me around her. And then ultimately, she got me to go to university at Chapel Hill because it's pretty awesome institution, and she was there.
Sure is.
A double win.
Yeah, I was going to say, man, you hit the jackpot, dude, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Been very lucky.
Absolutely, man. Well, all right, so let's get back to, I'm always, and I think a lot of people are always kind of interested in, you know, boot camp, basic training stories. You've got a couple of nicknames that I'm just going to mention and let you roll, but we got Piggly Wiggly, Gelding, Biggie Smalls, and I'll just let you take that from there. Some impressions and funny stories from basic and boot camp and culture shock and whatever other observations you have.
Yeah, it was culture shock for me coming from Oregon and not really totally understanding what the military was about. And then as an infantryman going into basic training, it's you stay with the same people throughout the whole time. You have the same drill sergeants from beginning to end. And people come from all different walks of life and come into the military. And our drill sergeants that I had in my particular unit, they were interesting, and they kind of they can pick who they're going to make the leadership in our unit. And so it's a basic training unit, but you have people that lead you or in charge of you and responsible for things that you do, your schedules, your fire guard, stuff like that. So in my mind, the way I looked at it, this kid from Oregon, they picked all the older kind of thuggy gangster guys that decided to join the military a little bit later, and they put them in charge. And there's one particular guy who's from New York, and he was very proud of the fact that he was a gangbanger, and they just nicknamed him Biggie Smalls, put him in charge of everybody. He's kind of a big dude. There was another guy that they put in charge of one of the squads. I can't remember where he's from, but he resembled Piggly Wiggly, the character,
the cartoon
from the grocery store. And our drill sergeants, you know, they put a bag, like a paper bag, on his wall locker, and they would not let him remove it. And he had no other name. It was Piggly Wiggly only. And that's the only way we could speak to him or he could answer. We talked to him. And so everybody was getting nicknames. And I had an early nickname. I don't even remember what it was. But one day, one of my drill sergeants was talking about horses and in particular studs. And I don't even know why I piped up, but I mentioned that, you know, that studs were breeding male horses and used specifically for breeding. And he started, oh, so you know about horses, started asking me some questions. And somehow he asked me about other male horses that weren't used for breeding. And I said, well, there's geldings. He's like, what's a gelding? I'm like, well, it's a male horse that's been fixed. And forever after that, for the rest of the time I was at Fort Benning, Georgia, I was the gelding.
That was probably something looking back you might not have told him now, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think if I've learned anything in my life, and I like to talk, and I'm pretty glib, but it's maybe think before you say things, and maybe assess the situation a little bit better. So I guess I'm still learning that, but I do understand that's an issue for me. But it gave me a funny nickname, and it stayed with me all the way up until the point where the drill sergeants marched us into airborne school and turned us over to the black hats or the instructors of that school, and then that nickname died, and I pretty much lived by my last name from right. then on.
And then just to clarify, your boot camp was at Fort Benning in Georgia, is that right?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, all right. And is that where all airborne go to train? You know, like the Marines have Paris Island, and out here, I'm drawing a complete blank, near San Diego.
Yeah, so it's
just down the road. But is that where all airborne goes?
So it is where all airborne goes for airborne training, but it's specifically for like how you guys have Paris Island. And,
yep.
And it's the home of the infantry, and now it's the maneuver center. So when I went to basic training at AIT there, only infantry guys went to school there. That's morphed now, and now they have basic training for all different types of MOSs or career specialties. But at the time, it was just infantry. And then after your basic and AIT was finished, no matter where you went to basic training, at the time, Oklahoma was where artillery went, and I think Knox or something was where the tankers went. They would all... if they were going to be airborne, usually not tankers in that case, but they would go to Fort Benning for airborne training. And that could be early in their career or even later as they're going to an airborne unit. But yes, it also trains the Marines and the Navy and the Air Force airborne soldiers as well.
Okay. Camp Pendleton. God, I'm drawing a... what it is. I've passed it 1,000 times in my life and it's dropped off.
You're not one of those Hollywood Marines. You went to the real one. I'm just playing. I'm just teasing. There's so much funny back and forth between Marines, and you hear them, well, Paris Island, you know, it's Pendleton. It's the best.
No question, man. No, it's funny. I was like, because I was... I didn't end up making it, but in 2004 I was going to go to OCS and go back to Quantico to do training, and we went down to Pendleton a few times, and the naval a staff sergeant I had at the same time, some of the guys were talking mess about the Navy, and the staff sergeant said, hey man, don't ever forget that if your sorry asses ever need a ride, we've got to hitch it with the Navy. So just remember that. And so that always kind of put things in perspective to me. But
it does, and I think the military's got so much fun rivalry, and we talk a lot of trash on each other. But at the end of the day, we all do love each other, and nobody is an island that can stand alone. And the Marines know they're dependent on the Navy to get them anywhere. And I think the Army understands that with the Air Force as well. And it's true. I mean, what's an infantryman by himself? He's nothing. I mean, he doesn't have bullets. He doesn't have beans.
That's right.
He can't really do anything without all the support from all the other branches and the other MOSs and AOCs in the military.
Yeah, no question about it, man. Yeah. So... now the your basic, now this is, you knew you want to be a PT at this time. Now you still, is it the same thing with the Marines where, you know, every Marine is a rifleman? Is it every airborne guy has to be jump qualified, all that, do all that sort of training, even if your job was you knew you were going to be a PT?
So we're different than the Marine Corps, where I would argue that every soldier is not necessarily a rifleman or an infantryman. We all have basic soldier tasks that we're trained in, but we're a larger branch, and I think there's more specialty type jobs, and it's definitely different. And my first enlistment, totally, absolutely nothing to do with a PT, and now being a PT has absolutely nothing to do with me formerly being an infantry guy or even a JTAC in the Air Force.
Oh, okay.
The
okay.
skills don't translate at all. The only thing I think that really translates is you get the skill badges and the buy-in from doing kind of the cool Army infantry, airborne ranger stuff, that when now you're a medical provider, people trust you more, at least soldiers do, if they know that you've gone through what they've gone through and they've seen. So not a very small percentage of the Army would go through airborne school, and the vast majority of PTs, an even smaller percentage, would not be going through airborne school or those kind of things. So it's definitely, I think it's more specialized than the Army, but they're different animals, those two services.
For sure.
It's interesting to look at them. But as a physical therapist, it was a great stepping stone for me to have had the prior Army experience. Your Marine friends will tell you the Army is all about badges and tabs. And to some degree we are, but that's how you can kind of like, it gets you through doors, and you know, like things are opened up for you if you have airborne wing, so you can get your foot in the door and talk to people, especially the people that run the military, which is the ground pounders, the infantry guys, those are the powers that be in the military. So if you have something that relates you to them, you can get their voice, get their ear, I guess, faster. They'll hear your voice. You can always screw that up, of course.
Yeah, right.
But it opens doors.
Gotcha. Yeah. It's funny. I think the Marines make up about, I think it's 9% or 11% of the total military. So it's obviously a smaller, much smaller branch. And then, I think there's a perverse, the infantry guys I met in the military and the Marines almost took a perverse pleasure in getting the Army's cast off. And like, we always got the secondhand rifles, and you know, the Army had moved on to M4s and the Marines were just getting M16s. And so anyway, just on and on and on. It's funny, the little things. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, as I say, it is funny and it's interesting. And I think there is a huge pride factor in all the branches, but the Marine Corps in particular, that they do more with less, and it's pretty noble. But I'll say this, as we were rolling over the berm into Iraq, and I was actually in the Air Force attached to the Army, we had some Marines just to the other side of us, and they're in their soft-skin Humvees. We had soft-skin Humvees too. This is early. But our gunners that were sitting there, they had a steel plate across their chest and like the cupola that they're sitting on top of a vehicle. And the Marine Corps guy is just, the Marine's just sitting there open. And he's like, whoa, wait a minute. What do you think? I'm bulletproof? So they crossed into Iraq with less shield, older weapons and stuff. But they're awesome and they're super proud guys and they've accomplished a lot. And it's fun to watch and it's fun to work with them and to play with them.
No, like you said, man, I got lucky because the guy that was my recruiting captain had already been to Afghanistan or Iraq, and he had kind of, it was a little bit older. So he could, the rivalry stuff, he kind of always put it in perspective for us. Like, don't ever, you know, just never forget we're branches from, we all work for the same boss, and that's the American people. So, you know, just never lose sight of that in terms of the rivalry. So it's just stuff that I'd heard, and this has been so long. I'm so far out of the loop with the Marine Corps that I didn't even make it. I partially ruptured a disc in my back, and that captain said, "Well, your package probably has a pretty poor chance of getting through at 29 years old, which was the cutoff age." So that was my extent of my experience. But I had a quick question. I know what JTAC stands for, but for the acronyms, for those that don't, do you want to explain that real quick with the Air Force?
So it's a Joint Tactical Air Control, essentially. How to explain it? So TACPs, it's like a forward observer for aircraft. It's a liaison to the Army. And I was actually, I kind of misstated a little bit, so some walk back. I was actually the apprentice to the JTAC. And even though I was senior because I had that Army experience and rank, the JTAC, the Terminal Attack Controller that I was working with, was actually a guy with lower ranking than me. So I was like his ROMAD, his radio operator, maintainer, and driver, but we're forward observers that will laze or call on targets, like the bombing runs,
yep,
or even the strafing runs from aircraft that could come from the Navy, the Marine Corps, or the Air Force, or even foreign aircraft as well. But it's a really cool special job in the Air Force that's in the Air Force, but a liaison and attached to the Army that really advises the ground commander on the 5,000-pound bombs and whatnot you can bring to the battlefield pretty quick. And so it's awesome, it's exciting, and then the commander on the ground, obviously, whether it be the Marines or the Army, they decide where you're going to place that, but you're the person that controls that munition in that platform onto the target.
Yeah, I was the reason I kind of wanted to key on that when you said that is that I visited all four branches when I was thinking about signing up just to see what was on offer. And I just remember going to the Air Force, and I thought that job sounded almost cooler than any other job. You know what I mean? So, I just remember that. I always thought that sounded like a really awesome job. So thanks for explaining.
It's funny, when you're deployed with the Army and you're in the Air Force, I think there's a little bit of a jealousy thing there. And same thing when you're with the Marine Corps, they look at the Air Force like, man, these guys are really, they're living the good life.
Good life.
We were a very small team that brought a specific, you know, set of munitions and milk, just the power that the Air Force brought into the fight. And there wasn't a bunch of us attached to an Army brigade, but the Army guys would always want us to pull security with them and do their little, I don't know, the details, like beyond you know, the talk guard list and bring people into the tactical operations center. And we'd say, hey, no, you know, we have to be available for our job. We're on call for that all the time. And then they try to get somebody with a rank to look in. There's actually a memorandum of agreement between the Army and the Air Force where the Air Force people generally don't do those Army things for the Army. But when they'd push it every once in a while, if I was being funny, I'd look at their name tag and then their U.S. Army tag, and I'd look at you and I'd say, U.S. Army, us Air Force, a point at my own, right. And say, we're going to do our thing. You have a good day.
Do your day. Have a nice day.
Absolutely. But really, joking aside, it was about being available. And when you only have a small amount of people that can do a task, you definitely don't want to put them in charge of the burn pits for the dung for the camp.
So. Yeah, right. Exactly. No question, man. No question. So before we get out of basic, you've got a few stories maybe you can quickly go through that I kind of found amusing, man, with the brown recluse spider and the guy that was dead and then not dead and a few others, man. So if you wouldn't mind just ripping through those real quick, I kind of enjoyed it.
So the Army, I think they're trying to stress you out when you're in basic training AIT, and there's a little bit of a, I think there's, oh, not a little bit, there's probably a lot of lying that occurs to a soldier who really doesn't know any better and has no way of fact checking anything. You don't have internet access, you don't have a phone. And so your drill sergeants will tell you things and you pretty much just believe it at face value. One of the things that we definitely knew would happen is that if a soldier was dropped out of our training for whatever reason, we had this bay that we all trained in, and as they dropped off, they would just flip their bed up, make it, lock their locker, and they were gone, and we never saw them again. And we had one of our friends, one of the kids that was with us, he was bitten by a brown recluse spider. Oof. Pretty nasty, you know, pustule, gross-looking, festering wounds. And he was with us for, you know, a little bit after that. And they're like, oh, it's a spider bite, no big deal. And then he disappeared. And they flipped his bed up, did the whole nine, put a lock on his locker. And so we asked, hey, what, you know, what happened with this kid? And they're like, oh, well, he died. He died of complications from that spider bite. And we're just like, whoa. So some of his really close friends in my basic training AIT, they wrote his family letters, you know, condolences and sorry for your loss and all that. And they're not told by the drill sergeants that this was not necessarily true. And they actually got letters back from the parents kind of like, what are you talking about?
Jeez.
And they found out that the kid was pulled from training, but only temporarily, and he was in a clinic and he was recovering. And then he ended up coming back into our class. But yeah, they just, you know, thought it would be kind of funny to let us think this kid had died. And we were pretty broken up on it. It was like, whoa, that's pretty insane.
Your drill sergeant's got a good laugh out of that for sure.
Oh, absolutely. I just so many little funny things. And I know they were constantly pulling pranks on each other. And we had these three drill sergeants who were mainly in charge of my platoon. And two of them were just, I don't know how to explain it, but the guys had rhythm. And you know, in the military, there's all this drill and ceremony. And so our two drill sergeants that were really, really good would lead us and teach us all the drill. And we were competing in a drill competition against the other units that are training with us at the same time. And we were the best. We knew it. Our drill sergeants sang the best. They had great rhythm. We moved. We looked very sharp. We did fancy stuff. But as I think a joke, when the competition came around, the third drill sergeant, who had absolutely no rhythm, lead us. And so we looked horrible and we looked ate up. And the other drill sergeants are all laughing at this drill sergeant who's trying to drill us and make us do all the proper turns and do the rifles the right way. And we just looked like a soup sandwich. And so I think they got a kick out of that. And then that drill sergeant, you know, what is wrong with you? You're supposed to be the best. And he's smoking us for, in my opinion, his clear incompetence. But I think it was a lot of fun. And it was even probably worth it for the two guys that were good with drill to get a good laugh out of us losing. But by watching that guy really uncomfortable, which I think the military likes to do that. You clown on people and you just push their buttons just enough to annoy them and get them going. So it's a fun experience. And you definitely, you learn to have some thick skin and then you learn to kind of be mean to your guys, you know, your boys. You tear them down, but then you build them up, and it's a lot of fun.
I hesitate to call it hazing, but it's because that's taken on a bad term, but in a positive term, as I explained to my wife, like she never understands why, you know, I call up my cousin or my old buddies and we'll spend the first 5-10 minutes of a conversation, like cussing each other and like calling each other really bad names. And then we move right on to whatever we were talking about. And I was like, I guess that's kind of almost a camaraderie thing, man. Like, you know, for my basketball team, I my nickname for them for a long time was Slapdicks and, you know, whatever else. And yeah, anyway, so I would imagine it also builds a lot of camaraderie though, too.
It does. And I think that's something that the military is always going to have. And it changes over time. And you're right that there's been some weird, bad hazing incidents, but the spirit of that type of behavior, I think, really makes you closer. And when you have to be in a foxhole with somebody and you have to do rather uncomfortable things with a team of people, it helps to really know them and to understand what makes them tick and breaking them down a little bit, yep. And breaking you down and then having that love for each other. It's important and it works, and it's been successful for a long time for us.
I worked for a head coach named Max Good, who coached basketball for 45 years and at Loyola Marymount here, and still in touch with him. But he used to say that the kids don't care about what you know until they know you care. And, you know, he's got more colorful curse words and insults than anybody I've ever known, but he really cares about his kids, man. So, yeah, I always thought that was definitely true in terms of building, and especially even more so with what you do, because the stakes are so much higher, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and then real quick, man, I couldn't get out of this without the one story. I'm milking it for stories, but you got a Kevlar helmet and a nickname head.
Oh, I almost forgot to go there. So we had one kid in my unit who literally had the biggest head I've ever seen on a human being in my life. And I've been around for a while, medically and otherwise, but his head was so big that the standard and even the extra large Kevlars that were available at Fort Benning and actually the whole army, were not big enough for this kid. And so everywhere that we would go, we'd all have our Kevlar helmets on, the battlefield helmet, and we'd march around. But he didn't have a helmet because his head was literally too big for them. He had to wear a soft cap, like the military patrol cap. And even the largest one of those, they had to cut a triangle out of the back.
Damn.
So it was probably an extra 3-inch triangle at the bottom just to get the largest cap on his head. But the Army, you know, ordered from the manufacturer a larger Kevlar and had it special made for this kid. And the good news was, is it got there right before a pinnacle of the training where we had to do our confidence courses and do our big climbs and show that we were not afraid of heights and able to work in that kind of environment. So he got his Kevlar the day that we arrived at the confidence courses. So he marched the confidence course. We went up and were climbing all these obstacles, and he was kind of in the middle of the pack to climb up to one of the taller, it's probably, I don't know, 2 or 3 stories or whatever, high. And then it was basically one tree to another one. And I don't know, 15, 20 meters between the trees, and you'd have to navigate on a rope, a climbing rope that you could like go underhand or shimmy across the top or however you wanted to do it. But the kid gets up there at the top of the first part of the obstacle, and they're like, okay, now negotiate to the other side. And he's like, no. And he's just terrified, and he's holding onto the tree with like a death grip. And they keep it, you need to get out there, or we're going to kick you out of that tree. And they're yelling at him. And he's like, nope, not going to do it. Not going to do it, shaking his head. And so finally, one drill sergeant climbs up there, tries to pull him down. He can't get him down. They have to have like 2 or 3 guys up in the tree and physically and manually pull him out of the tree and lower him back down to the ground. So the very same day that he got his special Kevlar head, also got kicked out of the Army. And you can't have a guy that's deathly afraid of heights and will refuse an order just because of a fear of heights.
That's right. Yeah.
So he left, and they took that giant Kevlar after they threw up his bunk and they put it on top of his wall locker. So we saw this giant dome. It was very Darth Vader-esque. Or actually not Darth Vader. What's the cartoon? Not the cartoon, but the knockoff of it. I'm trying to remember. Lord. Oh shoot! It's the Mel Brooks movie. Darth Helmet.
Darth Helmet. Yeah. Darth Helmet.
Yes, it was more like that. It was ginormous.
So. Yeah, Schwartz is bigger than mine. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Exactly. No, the stresses that it puts on. You find humor in it later, but I'm sure head was broken up about it. So.
I'm sure it was, and I've met some guys that ended up getting out of the military for things like that, or even I had a guy that was. He was a machine. He was this big, giant, corn-fed kid from Wisconsin, a Hispanic dude that was just a horse. He was a big man in like every way. And he was awesome. I was in a weapons squad at the time, so we had machine guns, and he was my ABAG, and he would carry everything, and he's just super strong and super motivated. But he looked bad in military uniform because he was big, just a right. big dude. They ended up kicking him out, not for failing anything. He passed his PT test and everything, but for just appearance in military uniform, which I disagree with. I don't think
interesting. I didn't even know that was a thing.
I'm not a fan of it. And to be honest with you, I mean, this guy was a benefit to the team. Like a pack mule, but he was a good guy too. And so it was awesome to have him. But he got out of the military, and I think he was probably pretty bitter about it. But we reconnected later on, and he actually went into the guard afterwards. He got back in the military because he hadn't failed any standards. And he still does it, and he still loves it, and he's grown. And although that, I think that was unfortunate for us and for him, it's a thing. Not everything's perfect. But yeah, there are some bitter stories.
Yeah, well. For sure.
But he loves the military still, as they actually just reconnected with him about a year ago, so it's interesting.
Nice. Well, so after basic, you get in. You now, where have you spent time, if any, overseas in your time?
So when I first came in, I stayed at Fort Bragg and just did training and fun stuff, and then did Army training up and down the East Coast. And then I got out and joined the Guard, and that's the first time I deployed to Iraq. And then I came back in as a PT, where I stationed in Texas going to school, and then Virginia. I was at Belvoir in a hospital. And then I got assigned to another infantry unit, but as a physical therapist in Italy with the 173rd Airborne. Oh, so I actually did go back on jump status for that, so I stopped being a leg for a few minutes. So I lived in Italy, but then immediately deployed to Afghanistan with that unit, which was tough, but also a really rewarding experience. It was neat to provide care for the guys that were like I was as a kid. But I'm telling you, when I was a kid growing up in the infantry, we were playing and it was training. There was nothing that we didn't get called. The flag didn't go up. I didn't have to do anything crazy. These kids had to do it, and they've been doing it for a long time.
Right.
And it's tough to see those kids and what they're going through and the loss that they've had. But and my wife too, she was over there in Italy, and when the families would be notified of a death, a lot of times the women would be together. And I think that probably hit the women harder than the men, because the men were separated geographically across Afghanistan.
Right.
And so we knew and we'd hear of it, but the women were there, you know, comforting each other. And it's so interesting. But
out of sight, out of mind type thing with when you're doing it and some guy goes, you just kind of have to, you still got a job to do. But I imagine the wives and the families back home have to deal with the long-term effects of that right away. So yeah, that's a good point, man.
Absolutely. And I was fairly new to the unit. Like, I just got there before we deployed, so I had formed a lot of the relationships. And the more you know people, you know, obviously it hurts so much more if it's family, that kind of thing when you see it. So as the time went on, as the physical therapist for the brigade, I would go and see all these kids all over Afghanistan and get to know them and get to meet their medics and their teams. And so it gets tougher as you go, but being with the 173rd is awesome. It's a great unit. Sky soldiers, they're fun, they're cool. They've got a ton of Medal of Honor winners. They've just been in really tough and awesome situations. But then I came back and we lived in Italy, and with my family there. I mean, my kids have been like 40 countries, just
driving, nice.
You know, Asia, all of Europe and North Africa. So really, really cool, great, fun experience for my family after the tough experience of that deployment.
So. Now, where exactly in Italy is this?
So it's northern Italy. It's basically, it's very close to Venice. It's in Vicenza, Italy. So it's near Padova, Venice, and Milan. It's kind of sandwiched between those major cities. It's awesome part of the country. It's right off the Alps. Beautiful, great wine country. Great cheese, great olive oil, great people that really took good care of the military. So I was in Caserna Ederle, which is like the post name for the 173rd headquarters, and then Caserma del Din, the two little army installations right there in northern Italy.
Not a bad place for your family to do some time, man, for sure.
Not at all. And I think it really was special for my kids and for my wife, because I've been fortunate that I've been able to travel because of the military, but the civilians don't really get that. But then when you get stationed overseas, they really have the opportunity to see the world and see a little bit of what we see in a little bit less threatening manner. And they just really embraced traveling and looking at other people's cultures. And even while I was deployed in Afghanistan, they went to tons of countries, just, you know, just packed the kids into the van, and my wife drove all over.
Yeah, yeah, being in that proximity, I did grad school in England for 4 years, and definitely used that time to go to every single country I could get into when basketball season and school wasn't in session over there. So it was, yeah, I agree, totally great experience. Let me ask you this, man. So you said you were in Iraq and also Afghanistan. And as you can talk about as much as you're comfortable talking about, but I'm curious as to your opinion in terms of, like, what were your impressions going into those places? And then obviously you saw the results, man, like, you know, guys getting injured and having to rehab, and you were in charge of that. So kind of did your view of the whole thing change? Did you, what were your impressions of both Iraq and Afghanistan, and where were you?
Oh man. So it's, I don't know. It's a tough question because it goes back to the military. And you could even ask, like, is there a reason for being there? And I think ultimately there is. I mean, there's definitely some problems, especially specifically when you're looking at Afghanistan, but the same thing in Iraq, that we feel like we can help the people in those countries. If you look at, like, stories or news articles or even books from Afghanistan in, like, the 60s and 70s, you see this modern progressive society.
Definitely. Yep.
And now you see this totally weird, you know, it's like a third world country. And people choose what they want to be. And I think we should facilitate that as much as possible, but it's freakishly dangerous. And I don't want to, you know, judge a culture, but there are definitely issues in that culture that we just can't, as freedom-loving Americans, just understand and support. And I'll leave it at that. Mm-hmm. I think that we did a lot of good. I think that it's always, time will tell. I think that there's always mistakes made, and that building a nation is difficult. Supporting a nation
for sure
is difficult. And people got to want to make things better for us to help them get better. And it's just, that's never going to be an easy task. And that's difficult. But as I flew all over Afghanistan, I was mostly in RC East. You would see how beautiful that country was.
Yep.
And it's pretty sad that it's been torn by war for so long, and even before us with the Russians and everything else. But it's beautiful. There's some great people there. They have the civilian population, the people there. They protect strangers. There's a lot of love there. So there's goodness, but it's also sad to see the way that they live and just how little we can actually do to kind of to bring them along and improve them. Iraq, totally different. I had no idea what I was going into. I wasn't really worldly looking at it, but it was crazy. And we got there before a lot of the V-bid, the really lethal IEDs were going off. And I traveled from Kuwait. This is after the initial ground invasion for the second war. So as things were just starting to be figured out, as we were kind of occupying space, and I went from Kuwait all the way up to Baghdad, and then I was mostly on the eastern side of the country in a place called KMTB, or Kirkush Military Training Base, pretty close to the Iranian border. We had that sector from Baghdad all the way east, north of Mandalay was kind of like our northern border. Beautiful country. I've driven through Babylon and orange fields and across the Tigris and the Euphrates and seen, but then also sad and crazy. And their cultures, it's just different. I mean, different than anything you've seen, even if you've been to other parts of the Middle East and in North Africa and Europe and Asia, whatever. It's tough. I feel for those guys. And they were terrified of us when we got there. I mean, the ground invasion had just gone off, the massive air campaign. And that's a scary, scary thing. So we would drive by and we'd try to throw candy to the kids, or like if somebody sent me a blow up ball, I'd throw it to the kids. And at first when we'd throw stuff, they'd run away because they thought we were trying to kill them.
Yeah.
But obviously not what we were trying to do. And then they finally figured out that they could, you know, talk to the soldiers, and they started selling us stuff, cigarettes and homemade Coke, or I don't know, whatever
it was. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's sad to see that kind of poverty. It's sad to see what they're going through. And I believe in my heart of hearts that we try to make those places better and that we have very good visions, but we've made some mistakes along the way. And that's, I think anybody will tell you that, as they're looking back, and it's hard to unseat a government and all the people that are in positions of power, and to have the ability to make the government work. It just totally we'll call debathification of Iraq and get rid of that political party and then expect them to be successful. And they've been struggling with that ever since. And the people that took power after the normal political powers maybe were forced out, I don't think they necessarily had the best interests of the people. They may have had the best interests of their maybe their family or their clan, but not the whole of the people in Iraq. And there's interesting divides in the Middle East that come from well before that war. I think that the British and the French have some responsibility on who was in power and what the ruling classes were. But it's difficult. It's tough, and it makes me sad to think that we're still having to do what we're doing in both those countries.
Yeah, it's really, I've studied quite a bit, as much as a civilian can, obviously, to try to pay attention and try to understand what was going on during that time. And, you know, I had a couple of Kurdish classmates were in grad school who would, you know, go back during the off time and fight with their local militia and then come back to grad school, and just had some really interesting, but I find that whole thing, obviously, what you said about nation building, that's a separate thing. Whatever side of the divide you fall on, that's not the point of this, of talking to you about it. I was just curious of the impressions, and it's really interesting. I'm curious of the impressions of someone who was actually there in your capacity. So I appreciate you sharing that. And it's, you know, I think it's probably it's something that's faced whether it was my stepfather who was in World War II and the surrender of Japan, and you know, having to deal with a place like Iraq, who was run by a dictator, man. And we had to do it for the Nazis. We had to do it for, you know, and similar thing. I mean, that was a totalitarian society. And then on top of that, you add, you know, a minority population of Sunnis ruling a majority population of Shia, and then you have Iran's influence, and you know where you were close to, and so there's just so many. The Middle East is always that way, you know what I mean, and it goes back thousands of years. So
it is, and it's interesting. We've in the military, we partner with a lot of the other Middle Eastern countries too, and that's been a really phenomenal experience for me. And I think in Afghanistan, the closeness that I have with the Jordanian army.
Interesting.
Awesome. I was working basically Charlie Med, like a medical company attached to the 173rd. And right next to us, we had the American surgical team and then also the Jordanian surgical team and their officers. And they were awesome. We would dance with them, we'd party with them, smoke and talk. And those guys became really good friends with them. And they gave me, you know, the Jordan River water. It's like, you know, tell a little story about Jesus and how he was baptized. And then this thing that they give to the friends of Jordan. And so great relationships with other countries, and seeing how those people from the Middle East are also, you know, vested in the security and the safety of that area. So it was good to work with those guys and kind of get their feel for what it was too, because it's different. I mean, they see the world from a different set of lenses if you live in the Middle East, or
100%, man,
in the Middle East. And it was good to have kind of confirmation that at least these guys would thought we were doing the right thing, and we're helping, you know, try to make it a more stable and safer environment for everyone worldwide, but especially there in the Middle East.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's, it always is interesting. And I think that leads back to a commonality, you know, that people in the service have, that get a chance to travel. And I've been lucky enough to fill up a couple of passports in my life too, and live in a bunch of places. And I think that's just an education you can't get in books. And it's sitting like you have with whether it's Jordanians or other officers from other militaries of other countries. And you get a chance to break bread and have a drink and have a smoke with these guys. And you really, it's always been really fruitful for me, man. And I'm sure you feel the same, in sense of like just the downtime and talking about family, religion, girls, life, sex, whatever the case is, you know, and you realize commonalities and differences, and people that live in that neighborhood, man, that's a dangerous neighborhood, man. So, you know, it's cool to get that point, really interesting and broadening, hopefully, to get to point of view. And it's something that I think in the military probably does a good job of exposing soldiers to that.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of the reasons why soldiers are so well-rounded, and they, not just soldiers, but military in general,
right.
unless they're like, you know, just barracks rats and they never leave an experience. We're putting so many great opportunities to see the world, and even the difficult positions like the combat positions. We are usually working with a coalition of other soldiers from around the country, and you can get to see where we're similar. And at base, I think everybody is very similar. With the other day, we're all there for the same reason. We love our countries, and we're there to make things better. But it's been a lot of fun, and you're right. There's, I think one misconception is that like you watch war movies and there's all this action all the time.
Right,
there's
right.
a lot more downtime than there's action time, and so there you get a lot of just time to smoke the hookah with the guys in the hooch next door to you. So it's fun, and you learn about everything, and it's great to see how much we actually have in common.
Yeah, absolutely. No, 100%. That's a great attitude. And that's, I think, one thing that that traveling does force you to do if you're doing it right, and not just, as you say, just kind of sitting in your hotel room or your resort, or in your case, just sitting in your barracks and not getting out, branching out and meeting people. And I think that's one of the really, really awesome opportunities that the military does give you, is a chance to do that. And it's also, I brought up I was talking with another gentleman who is in the Army, and it really forces you to, you really, in a lot of ways, you're doing your job there, but you're also a diplomat and you're representing 330 million Americans there as well. Because I always thought, wherever I was, maybe this is the only time this person ever gets a chance to meet an American. And so not like I'm that presumptuous to think I carry the weight, but as when you put that uniform on, you really do, whether you like it or not, you do represent us, So, you're also a diplomat in addition to being a PT, in certain ways.
I would agree with that. I would say this, it's definitely not just the military and the uniform. Everybody in the world knows an American, and they can spot them
for sure,
a mile away, the way we carry ourselves.
Yep.
And it's the way that we've been brought up, and just kind of that we have an ease moving through crowds and this comfortability and we're gregarious and loud and very, very confident. And sometimes that's off putting to people. I'll be honest with you. They see that, and like the loud American is kind of this ugly picture that you'll see, especially in Europe. But at the end of the day, I've never met anybody from Europe, when they get to know an American who's not just a clown, that really has a lot of respect and love for those people that are choosing to immerse themselves in somebody else's culture. And Americans do that. And sometimes it's just, voyeurship, tourism, whatever we go in. But most Americans, I think, really want to see and learn from other people. And I would say it's not just the military. Every single one of us, when we get on a plane and we cross the Atlantic or the Pacific, the second we get off, everybody's looking at us. They have questions. They want to know. They're forming their opinions. And it's funny because, when you first talk to somebody who's never really been exposed to Americans, they have some misconceptions similar to how we would of them, I guess.
Yep.
They assume we're very, it's everything's Hollywood and LA. Yeah. And it's, they can't even fathom that people grow up on farms or grow up like, or even how big America is. Like one of my Italian friends, and he's, traveled Europe a lot. But he was very excited because I was telling him after I was leaving Italy, I was going to go live in New York. And he's like, oh man, I need to come visit you. I'm like, you can come, you are more than welcome, but I'm not going to be in New York City. I'm going to be in upstate New York. And,
right.
And I don't think he had the concept of how far away, Fort Drum, Watertown was from New York. And he ended up going and visiting New York City. But as much as I love upstate New York, and I'm hoping I'm not giving them a bad name, but it's not the kind of place that most tourists want to go.
No question.
I will say I love the North Country, and that's some of the greatest people that I've ever met, and a hidden jewel in the military. Sometimes you hear bad talk about certain places that you can be stationed in, and I think just off the tip of your tongue, people will say Fort Polk, Fort Drum, those places I'd never want to go. I absolutely loved my exposure, my experience at Fort Drum. Loved the weather, loved how beautiful it was, and loved how close I was to Canada, Niagara Falls. I did a recruiting video for Fort Drum.
Oh, okay.
Those guys are fun, and it's the civilians there are really, really cool, and they are very pro military, and they love the service. So that was a great exposure for me and my family as well.
Yeah, you just hit up on everything you've just said right there. I've experienced and I've attempted to convey to people here about being overseas, whether you like it or not, the tension is on you. I think it's probably just because I wear shorts everywhere. I mean, you can kind of that's one thing, everybody. But no, you're 100% right, man. I guess that, as you mentioned too, it goes both ways. You go meet people and they're very curious because of obviously our media and our place in the world. I think it's similar to that old, if we were in the Roman Empire and we were stationed in North Africa, the locals would probably be those damn Romans, blah, 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 until they get to know people. And I think that's what's so important about, as you say, smoking hookah and breaking bread, having a drink, that breaks down those things, and hopefully you get out of that you do have a lot more in common as human beings than not. And so that's a cool experience, man. I think you've been really fortunate to have gone as many places, and especially being able to take your wife and kids there as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been great. And it's funny, like, you quite often get people will say, you know, thank you for your service. And I appreciate that. That's awesome. But I would say that the U.S. government has given my family and me a lot of gifts. And we talked about from the very front, you know, they paid for my undergrad education at UNC. And then they sent me to Baylor for my doctorate. And it's just a drop of what we get for serving. And we don't do it for that. I mean, we serve because we're serving. But it's really, really cool how people really open their hearts and their doors to American veterans and service members and really take good care of them. And I've had, I mean, people can tell we're military because of our haircuts and stuff. And people go out of their way to buy you a drink, ask you questions, even throw meals at you and stuff, which is, it's, you know, he's like, you don't have to give me a meal, but it's you can tell that people appreciate it. And that's everywhere. I've been all over the States and it's really, really a cool experience, especially to meet older veterans too, that are now thanking me for what we're doing in Afghanistan and Iraq. I'm like, man, I'm a physical therapist. Like, you were a door gunner in Vietnam. Like I can't even, you know, you propped us up. Like you're the man. Like you're my hero. I'm like a medical officer. It's not even the same world. But that's a lot of fun, and it's been cool. And I will say, I going across, no matter where I am, even across political divides, whatever, Americans are very, in my experience, very appreciative of the military and go out of their way to do good things for soldiers and for our counterparts in the Marine Corps, Air Force, and Navy as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. I did a show with a guy named Jay who's also in the Army, and we touched up on that thank you for your service thing. And I remember after 9/11, you know, you'd see obviously the operational tempo was pretty high, so there was a lot of soldiers deploying, and you'd see them in airports everywhere at that time. And so I was always curious about that. I never really said that, because I didn't want to, because my stepdad was, you know, grandfather's uncle's stepdad's, you know, all going back to World War I, and they always said, don't ever say that to me. He said, I get a paycheck for this job. And this is what Jay said. He says he really appreciated the, you know, the intention behind it. But, as my mentor was a Marine pilot, and he always in Korea and Vietnam, and he always used to just say, you know, buy him a drink and a lap dance or a burger or something. He'll be much more appreciative.
You're probably right. I think a lot of us are uncomfortable with it because, I mean, we're not doing it to be thanked. I guess that's the end of the day.
No question.
We appreciate it that people notice, but it does sometimes make us uncomfortable. We're like, you're welcome. What do I say?
What do you say to that? But, it's a nice sentiment though, for sure.
It
you know?
Is. Yeah.
Yeah, so what he said, he always responds to that by saying, "Hey, thanks for paying your taxes." He's like, I get a paycheck to go around the world and shoot things and shoot guns and blow up things. So appreciate the check.
So true. It's a lot of fun. We do get paid to do some pretty awesome things, and once you sometimes get away from those fun things, it almost makes you sad. Because like for me, growing up as an infantryman, and even when I was in the Air Force, like the jumping out of airplanes, the blowing stuff up, and I still shoot and do the Army things, but I'm not jumping out of airplanes on a regular basis anymore. And so you miss a lot of that fun stuff, and whatever little touch that we can get, we're always going to grasp onto. And I've been in the military for over 20 years, so sometime in the next 2 to 10 years, they're eventually going to kick me out, I imagine. And I'm going to miss it. This experiment that I did just to pay for college has actually become my life. And I can't even imagine not being around soldiers and not trying to make soldiers better and help them with their injuries and stay in the military and keep kicking doors down and doing what they need to for their country. So I know that's eventually going to end for me, but I'll be sad. It'll be a huge shift, although I'll probably enjoy camp couch and fishing as well. I think that's going to be, you know, Fort Living Room probably is also very attractive to me here in the future. So
I guess we're getting an early taste of this anyway, Peter, with quarantine, right? We're all at camp. We're all at Fort Living Room now, right?
Absolutely. It's funny. I just because we're medical and we run that operation, I don't get as much of the stay at home work as
true enough.
But I can see where I could really enjoy it. And there's probably some some jealousy, I think, from me towards some of the other people that are talking about how they haven't been into work in 30 or 40 days. I'm like, man, that would be nice. But I also get to get out and see the world still. And so there's some goodness in all that. And so hopefully as we uncoil and return to our new normal, we figure out a really good, safe way to do it. And for the military side, it's all about us being ready to go do what we got to do. And no matter what the medical health condition is, the military will be ready to go and do what we got to do when we're called upon. And
yeah, yeah.
Currently, you're doing it right now. So that's
great. Yeah, I've seen that. I was going to say, you guys get the rain, sleet, shine, pandemic, zombies, whatever. You guys got to be out there doing it. So
absolutely.
So yeah, for sure. I kind of wanted to just you mentioned in before the show, you kind of mentioned just a couple of things. Like, you get it. I think you're probably doubly fortunate in the sense that you get a chance to do a cool career, cool job. But within that cool job, being a physical therapist, you're in the business of helping to heal people, man. So like, you kind of had some. You mentioned it earlier, but in Iraq, Afghanistan, I'm pretty sure that those kids that you saw that really embraced their getting back to what they're doing and had some pretty horrible injuries, that was probably an inspiration to you as well, right?
It really is. And I'll tell you what, that's a constant inspiration. And we go in spurts of where we see it, depending on where we're stationed. And when I was in school in San Antonio, specifically that Center for the Intrepid, the amputee center, the amputee care, it's just seeing, soldiers, Marines, sailors, airmen that have, blast injuries, missing multiple limbs, burns, large percentage of their body, and their desire and their drive, not only just to get healthy and back to somewhat normal, but to get back in the fight and serve is really impressive. Actually, when I was in the 173rd, there was a platoon leader, and I didn't see his injury. I saw the aftermath, and I wasn't even the guy that did his rehab, but he was, while I was the PT for his brigade, he was a platoon leader with one limb, Ranger, wow. Infantry guy, jumping out of airplanes, jump master, doing the full hua, and he was harder than anybody. And right. It's just like, wow, this dude's got one limb, and he's doing the road marches, and he's doing the whatever, and it's inspirational, and it's cool to see. And I'll echo that. In San Antonio, I would play games when we were rehabbing the amputee soldiers and Marines, and one of the games we played is dodgeball, and they wouldn't want you to pull back on them. They wanted you to really play your heart out. They wanted to either win or get beat, fair and square. And that literally got to be fun. Like, you're trying to knock a dude off of his limbs.
You'd only get that in that setting, right? Like any other setting, if you saw it outside of the context, you'd be like, what are you doing? But you understand that, man. Yeah. That I'm sure you.
My kids are like, wow, you're real mean. I'm like, hey, these are guys that are trying to get back into shooting at people, into doing INTs, like reacting to actual contact, and so playing a little dodgeball and getting hit with a foam ball or a hand four square ball, not a big deal. These kids are tough. They're really tough, and they want it. They don't want it to be easy. They want to know that they can get back full on into the fight. And time and time again, I've seen soldiers just overcome, horrific injuries that are part of what we do. And it's amazing the human capacity to work and strive to get better. And it's amazing what we can do naturally and then what science and some orthosis and stuff can really help a person get back into and living. And it's what you can see a guy with a claw arm, what he can achieve and do, it's just really impressive. And not just to be somewhat normal, but to be lethal, to get back into the fight completely, and it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, that is really, yeah, that's cool. It's, yeah, anyway, I've got personal experience with PT and even my little partially ruptured disc. It's just amazing to get to the right. I had a PT, Michael Moore was his name of all things, but this is up north of Sacramento. Not that Michael Moore.
Yeah.
But this guy, I mean, I went to a couple of different ones before I got to him, and he just gave me some really practical things. He was a wrestling coach, and he challenged me, and like it got me back to where I was able to play basketball again for another 6 years overseas. And he just was, yeah, it's amazing. And that's just a disc injury. I can only imagine the gratification and the challenge you get from guys that with that kind of injury and had, and seems, obviously you can repair the parts of the body, but the mental aspect of that. And I think challenging them and treating them as normally as possible is probably a key part of that rehab, is just as anything, any physical thing you could do.
Absolutely. And it's cool and it's inspirational. And it's, I just a little sidebar on that. I think they purposely used to march like the basic training kids in San Antonio past that center for the Intrepid. Cause when you're on sick call in the military, you have to go to the hospital. The hospital's right next to the amputee care center. And so they'd march these kids with their, you know, hangnail or their, you know, whatever, stubbed toe. And, and they'd walk past a guy, literally 95% of his body is burnt and he's missing a limb. And they're like, ah, maybe my hangnail doesn't hurt that bad.
What's your excuse today, man?
But it's, you said about the back. I'll tell you what, it's that, the back and disc problems and just the back in general, it is such a monster. And you can see the studs of the world, operators, athletes, when that back is bothering you, it's a monster. So
no question.
Just getting people that can help you with your mobility and getting your core strength back and letting you know it's okay, it's normal, and you can overcome this and be fairly normal as long as you're doing your maintenance stuff is good. And I'm sure it helped you having a coach. It's kind of like me having like the Ranger tab or the
no doubt.
When I talk to a soldier, it's a buy-in. They say, hey, I'm gonna listen to this dude. He's like a Division I college wrestler or whatever it is. He knows what he's doing. He's competed at a high level. And so I use that a little bit myself just to get my foot in the door.
To get some buy-in, yeah. No, and it's no, go ahead, sorry.
You could have two equal guys tell you to do something, and if you believe in one guy, not the other, you're gonna get better and you're gonna listen to and you're gonna do what the guy that you trust and you believe in and you understand he's got similar experiences. It helps a lot. So
yeah, it's certainly true in basketball, man. Having played and kind of been able to talk to guys about in-game situations definitely helps with buy-in when you're trying to, you know, teach them a concept or alter their shot or something like that. And this guy, you know, walking in, I looking back, I don't know. I mean, I've been to a couple other PTs before, but walking in with him and just his whole bearing and how he kind of right away was very matter of fact and challenged me, man, like a coach would. I'm sure that was part of the reason I was so, you know, was fired up to do what he said. You know what I mean? So I'm sure that's part of it, you know?
Well, awesome. I'm glad you're able to get back to a high level with it. Cause it's tough. People sometimes, you know, that, oh, it's a disc injury. It's a big deal. I've seen it firsthand what it does to, you know, like operators and like super athletes. So it's
I was a mediocre, very mediocre D2 level on my best day basketball player. But I can imagine, but you know, when it hit me, man, I was it would incapacitate me, man. And I was just a partially ruptured disc. So I can, you know, that pain for months and months until I went to this PT and he helped me change a few things, man. Like I just, it was to the point where it kind of almost paralyzes you, man. And I can only imagine, you know, high level operators in your business or whatever that the soldiers that you have, man, with really bad injuries, man, that takes a level of mental fortitude. I don't even know if I have that. So that's even more impressive, man. So anyway,
yeah, it's amazing to see what they come through and what they do. And they surprise me all the time, it's a constant. The human spirit will always drive on and continue to strive for the best. So it's been good to watch.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's rewarding for me as well.
That's what I was about to say, man. That if I mean, all of us should be so lucky to have a career like that. So, and that kind of leads me, like, just to kind of wrap up, man. Like, do you? So now you've been in over 20. You said 20 years in the Army, and have your views of it changed, or how have they changed, or what? And obviously you're grateful for your time there. What are things that the Army, the military does well, and what are things that maybe it can improve upon? Just general kind of observations on your part as you kind of enter the tail end of your career.
That's interesting. I think what's probably surprised me the most is how much the military just is America. It's a microcosm society. And I think you know that, you feel that. But there is, I mean, we talk about there's only a small percentage in the military, or sorry, of the U.S. that joins the military.
That's right.
But it's a small percentage of everybody. I mean, you're going to get your cowboys from Texas, your hippies from Oregon, your beach bum from California, and your Midwestern guy. You get everybody. You get New York. You get
Biggie Boston. Smalls from New York.
Absolutely. And that diversity and that the bringing all this different thought into the military, I think makes it better. It's like You can work well with others. You may disagree with somebody politically or whatever, or even with how they want to take a hill. But at the end of the day, there's a structure and there's a way to get things done. And the cream really rises to the top in that. And it's fun. It's cool. It's social change all the time. And it's the front leading edge of it. Sometimes that's scary, but it's good. I mean, the military has always been at the forefront of that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And it's impressive. And I think a lot of times people think that military members are pretty backwards. I think there's not, I mean, you get the thank you, blah, 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 whatever. But a lot of people are like, oh, they went in the military because it was the only option.
Yep, I hear that a lot. That's one of the reasons I wanted to do this show was to kind of combat that, to be honest.
And in some cases, you know, they're not wrong. I mean, for me, I could have gone to community college. I could have done, you know, these other routes. But the military was a great opportunity for me. But I think I liken it to the GI Bill. I think originally when the GI Bill first started, I don't think that anybody in government thought it would be as successful as it was. I think they said, hey, we'll give this little gift as a token of our appreciation to veterans. But in reality, GI Bill has been so successful. Every, you know, service member that gets on that, they get it. They get a degree. They get training. And for example, I was a less than average, horrible student as a kid. But you give me a little structure, you put me in the military, and you grow up a little bit. I went to pretty decent universities in Carolina and Baylor. I was, you know, wildly successful. GPA, night and day difference.
Yep.
You know, and more challenging coursework, whatever. But I had grown up and I had the military expose me to things and make me think different and make me more disciplined. And so that's been good. Overall, the military is constantly changing, but it's always the same thing. It's always these people that want to serve, that want to protect their country and want to do right by the country. So it hasn't changed in that way for me, like where like, oh, I expect it to be one way and it's totally different. It is. I mean, it's harder, it's easier, it's better, it's more fun, it's worse than you could ever imagine at different times. But it is, like I said, I will miss it when it's done. And I'll probably somehow have to reconnect with prior military members in some way, if it's even just to drink beers at a VA or something when I get
no
older.
Question.
But I love it. It's been great. And it's just been rewarding. And I guess just the different type of people coming together and making things happen is been that's just awesome. It's been kind of surprising as far as what we can do better and what we're good at. It's almost the same thing, and I probably wouldn't change it. Military and government in general has to have redundancy and a whole lot of excess to make it work, because you can't be super efficient.
Yep.
When it comes to certain things. And yep. I think we've seen this with our response to a pandemic in the United States and across the world. When we've been super efficient with our supply chain, we don't necessarily have the things that we need when what's called proverbial shit hits the fan. You know
yep.
what I'm saying? And so in the military, you've got a lot of, you know, there's, it's like people be like, why does the U.S. spend so much money in military spending? Why is it so big? And why are there so many divisions? It's because it's got to be there just in case
it's right.
the fan.
Right.
And we spend a lot of money, but we're actually small compared to some of these other of our competitors, our challengers that are out there that would love to see us not be the superpower that we are moving forward. And at the end of the day, I think it's a good thing that we're here and that we're capable and that we feel very comfortable competing with even our near peers in a successful way. Because to us, winning matters. And it matters a heck of a lot more than a basketball game or
yep.
a wrestling match.
Sure it's enough.
And it matters not just to me. It matters to everybody that I, you know, my fellow Americans, no matter what their political views are or what they think. So it's big, it's powerful, and that's a good thing.
Yep.
It does have a little bit of excess that's built into it, and I'm okay with that.
Sometimes right.
it's frustrating to see that because you love efficiency. Like, take a supply. Man, it would be great if everything worked like Amazon. Like, just,
yeah, right, right. The Walmart supply chain, unfortunately, doesn't apply, right? Yeah.
Absolutely not. No, bullets and bombs are different, and we have to handle them different.
Yep,
and,
that's right.
And we're going to have to store some things, and we're not going to be as agile in some ways, but more agile because of it. So it's cool. I love it. It's been a lot of fun, and and I know we'll continue.
Yeah, you
passed my time in.
You brought up something interesting, and I it's a discussion I've had with quite a few Westerners wherever I've been, all whether I'm in Europe or Southeast Asia or North, whatever, which is the military question of a big. And I used to, when I lived in Taiwan and China, I used to always said, you know, 70-80% of the world's goods come through the Straits of Malacca. And I said, who do you think patrols those waters? You know what I mean? And or the same thing in the Middle East from the Straits of Hormuz or anywhere. I said, you know, we patrol those waters, and it's kind of a question of who do you want patrolling those waters? Do you want China doing it? Do you want Russia doing it? Do you want, you know what I mean? And I just thought that was a really interesting point and a really important one that I really agree with. It's that people need to, and again, you know, this the idea for this show has been germinating in my head for, you know, 20 years and traveling all those places, precisely because of what you and I talked about earlier with what you were mentioning about people you meet and maybe preconceptions that they have of Americans, and then obviously what we have of them. And if this little conversation can you know, help broaden that view out a little bit, then hopefully we've done something useful, you know what I mean? And that's the whole point of it, actually, just to get to know the individuals who do what you do. And so, yeah, anyway, man, I really appreciate it, man, unless you got anything else to add.
No, I'll say thank you for the opportunity. It's always fun to shoot the shit with another guy and just talk about things like that. But I agree, and I think what you're doing, it's good. I think that people understand, and, you know, that we're people. You know, we're here. We're just like you, and we're here for you and for us. And it's a lot of it's selfish. We're here for us because we want this great American experiment to continue long into the future. And it's been an awesome ride. And you asked about like the Iraq thing, and I think the vast majority of the time, Afghanistan, Iraq, World War II, whatever, we're sitting in a pretty good place, feeling like we did the right thing for the right reasons. And I'm not even going to shy away from that. I feel very strongly that that's what we do and that's what we strive for. But thank you for the opportunity and thank you for the time, and enjoy the rest of your afternoon.
Yeah, man, I appreciate it. Before we get out of here, man, I just a little housekeeping, but this podcast available on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, all of the above. And once again, Peter, thank you for and please thank your wife for loaning you out to me for a Sunday afternoon. But I really appreciate you sharing your experiences, man. And hopefully we get down the road, you feel like you want to chop it up again, we can do this again, man. So but I really appreciated you being candid and sharing your experiences, man. And I really enjoyed it.
All right, hey, thanks again, have a good night.
You too, man.